Hi, everybody. This is Strong Christian Female. We are interviewing Dr. Kelly Palfy this week. This is part of our YouTube series that's going to launch in a month. But you guys, I can't wait a month. So since you're already here, I love sharing this with you already. She's going to talk about her expertise, which is in identifying, protecting, and counseling trauma to men and boys. Now, hold your hats. I know most of you aren't men, and I know many of you aren't parents, but I really want you to hear what she has to say, because here's the situation. All of us are responsible to leave a legacy. All of us are responsible to raise up and love children. All of us are responsible to protect innocence. So she doesn't go doom and gloom. We don't go dark and scary, but we go honest and open, and we equip people. She is a believer. She's actually being interviewed for my America Unchained podcast as well. So if you subscribe over there, you'll see that soon. But she loves Jesus, and how she even got involved in this is something really powerful. So I want you to just listen, hear what she has to say, and learn and feel empowered. We are lions, okay? We are not sheep. So this is an exciting topic that is necessary, especially right now in our world. This is a generation that is being swallowed alive by our culture, and we are here to stop it. And part of knowing how to stop it is to equip ourselves to know what we're looking at. So without further ado, let's get started. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Strong Christian Female Podcast. I'm your host, Charity, and this is a community of women who want to be warriors for Jesus Christ. We are kicking off the desire to be comfortable and embracing a wholehearted abandonment to Him alone, not through legalism, not through works, but through His grace and mercy. We're going to overcome the lies of this culture and replace them with the eternal truth of God's Word. So, whether you're a student, a stay-at-home mom, a grandma, an entrepreneur, whether you're new to the walk of Christianity, or a veteran spiritual warrior, you are welcome here. Let's get started. I am excited today about our guest, Dr. Kelly Palfy. She is the author of Men 2. It is a book that is dealing with the sexual trauma and sexual abuse of men. This is an important topic for our society, for this time in history. But also, if you have boys in your life, this is a topic that is hard for them to talk about, and maybe even hard to recognize the signs of. So Dr. Kelly is here to talk to us today about that. And it's a very important, prevalent thing in my life personally. As many of you know, I have 3 sons, but also because I have engaged with men over the years that something happened to them and it made them struggle or feel shame. And I've never really known what to say to them, except that they are loved and that should not be the identity they carry. But I love that today I'm going to learn more from Dr. Palfy about what to look for, but also maybe how to steer those conversations. So Dr. Palfy, hello. I'm so excited you're here. And I know you've graciously said I can call you Kelly. So hi, Kelly.
Hi.
So Kelly, before we start, just tell us a little bit about who you are. How everyone has a story as to how they got into this and why you chose to write.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So it's a bit of a story. So prior to becoming a psychologist, I was a Royal Canadian Mounted Police officer. So I did active duty for about 13 and a half years. And I was always drawn to sex crimes. So I would take on these sex crimes investigations. And then in about 2002, I was asked to join this unit that was being developed called the Integrated Child Sexual Exploitation Unit. So we started up this unit in response to problems that already existed. So we had a big case come in from the U.S., actually. It was the Department of Homeland Security and your U.S. Postal Service that had done a joint investigation in regards to some suspicious packages. They discovered that they contained child pornographic images. And they, you know, basically did a proper investigation, gained a bunch of credit card numbers of people who had actually purchased these illicit images. So approximately 350 of these purchasers were Canadian. Several of them, 90 of them, I think, were residing in British Columbia, which is where I was residing at the time. So we developed this unit in response to this case and other ones of similar nature. And so we had to learn how to investigate these cases. We were starting to teach other agencies how to handle these cases, because of course we would farm the investigations out to the police in the jurisdiction where the offenders were living. I was the file coordinator for the RCMP's first sex tourism charge. So that involves where a Canadian travels abroad for the purposes of exploiting a child. So on several of these investigations, I was required to actually review the data, obviously. And I was seeing boys as victims. And I was very shocked. And to be brutally honest, I did not initially recognize it as abuse. And I'm very ashamed to admit that, but it's true. Because unfortunately, in these images, I mean, the boys are not always, there's difference. I don't want to ever negate the different types of sexual abuse. But, you know, oftentimes these boys are seen as willing participants because they're young and they don't know what they're participating in, right? It's not going to bother them until later on in life when they learn what they've done and the meaning behind this. So I initially missed it as abuse. And we had a private lecture from a pro hockey player, one of the first pro hockey players to ever come out with his abuse history. And he told us the reasons that he hadn't reported. And so I was just, it was like God opened my eyes. Honestly, I have to say God opened my eyes to this issue. I had been a corrections officer prior to becoming a police officer. And I remember being very confused of wondering, like, I'd grown up in a pretty gross environment, to be honest, and like the women in my world were not exactly healthy. And so I just remember wondering why there were so many men in jail compared to women, because I'd had bad experiences with a lot of women. So I was honestly very confused about this. But when this pro hockey player started talking about why he hadn't talked about it and how he'd turned to drugs and alcohol, the reasons he hadn't told like people that he was being abused, reasons like, you know, his coach was his abuser and his coach was potentially his means to go pro. And if he'd have reported him, that would have hampered his ability to go pro. He knew he had the skills and he knew his coach had the means to get him there. He also was raised in poverty and his career was literally lifting his family out of poverty. Plus, he felt that some of his parents' teammates knew that he was being abused, but did nothing. And that infuriated me, but it also opened my eyes, right, to the fact that we kind of ignore things that we see. And it kind of sounds crazy, but at the time I was going through significant bullying in my career and he talked about living this double life. So when he said those words, those really resonated with me because I too was living a double life. I mean, here I was a cop with a badge and a gun being bullied by my supervisors and I did not know how to stop it. So my heart really went out to him. And I always say fast forward a few years, I lost my career to the bullying and I was this is literally what brought me to my knees for the first time. So I was like, God, please, you have to give me something to be passionate about. I can't, no offense to waitresses, but I just didn't feel like I just could not go back to waitressing after having done all this work. And I was like, God, you got to give me a career to be passionate about or I might become suicidal. I don't even know, you know. So he reminded me of this lecture that I'd been in with Sheldon Kennedy was his name and how desperately I'd wanted to help him, but felt like I couldn't. So I got kind of like what you and I were talking about beforehand. God, if you open the doors, I'll go. So that was my prayer. If you open the doors for me to go to U of A, I will research this and find out why boys and men are not discussing this. So that's what I did was, part of it was conviction about having missed this. I was like, in my mind, I was aware that I was literally being trained as the subject matter expert and I was missing this. So if I'm missing this and I'm the police lady investigating it, what about the rest of the world? I was so excited to have the opportunity. So I went to U of A and I researched why boys and men do not disclose sexual abuse. And I can tell you there are a lot of reasons that span from when the abuse first begins to their entire lifetime. But that's a whole nother subject, and that's covered in my book if people want to learn about that. But that's how I got interested in this. And
So going back to this amazing reality check, like you said, at first you were honest and you said, I did not recognize this as abuse. That to me is so key for people. They need to hear this. They, for some reason, we box girls and boys when it comes to sexual abuse in different categories, especially if those boys are teenagers, in my opinion. Because if they're little boys, we're like, this is defilement. But if they're teenagers, we think somehow they're compliant. And then we don't know the whole story. Absolutely. Even if it's by a woman, like how many women have hit on their students and like for some reason they will convince the student he's complicit and compliant and he's and because of, like you said, it's a rite of passage. We don't look at it as predatorial or grooming. So let's start down this path. So as a mom, I am very hawkish about how much, where my kids go online, when they go online, who they talk to. None of them are on social media, even though I have two teenage boys. And my oldest is like, I don't even want a smartphone, Mom. I just want a phone. And so he has a phone, like an old school, like you have to like tab it to text, but he wanted it. I was like, okay, we have to, I understand we need to teach our kids to live in the world they live in. I recognize that. But what we as parents, I think don't often, stop and realize is the world is coming to devour our children and they are not adults. They do not deserve adult level privacy. They have not earned this place in life. So when you started recognizing this, I want to know as a parent, and I know that we could go in a lot of different directions because there's so much you've written about and so much you've even talked about. And by the way, this is a great time to mention this to those that are listening. Dr. Kelly has actually done an extensive podcast with Focus on the Family Canada. We will link that below as soon as that goes live in August. If this is out a little bit before it has come out, don't worry. When it comes out, we'll put it below. But she's gone into much more detail than what we're going to talk about today. But because one of the biggest passions I have in my heart is to protect our children, keep them safe, and if something has happened, pull them up out of shame and restore them. What would you tell parents they need to be either protecting their children from engaging with, or when you actually see signs, what we need to be looking for?
Okay, so first off, I would say that I would agree with you. The world we're living in now, we do not have the luxury anymore of not educating our children. We have to educate our children. And I know certain people, even my own advisor at U of A, would disagree with that. She would say it's not up to kids to protect themselves. But the reality is sexual abuse is so rampant and the predators are so rampant and they are not being properly policed because they are plentiful and our police are overwhelmed. I know that from the clients that I work with that tell me they don't have time to get to these files. And I know that from just my own previous work. So we have to educate our children about grooming, about sexual abuse. And I don't mean we have to scare them. Fear is learned. But we do need to teach our children that just because someone presents as lovely and kind and helpful and loving does not mean that they always have the right agenda. Not that everybody's bad, but that some people, you know, bottom line, if someone tries to touch you or show you illicit pictures, that's not good, right? Like you have to come tell an authority figure, your parent or a teacher or something that's not doing that. And if they don't help you, go tell someone else, right? And that, you know, so unfortunately we do have to teach our children these things. Myself and a colleague have just put out, it's in the process of being loaded. By the time this podcast is up, it will be available. But we've created a book series called the Creating Personal Safety Series, which is a 3-part book series so that, you know, parents struggling with, like, what do I say to my children about grooming, about sexual abuse, specifically male sexual abuse, you can just read your children these books. So And it has lists of what we feel is an appropriate, like age appropriate way to teach your children about abuse without scaring the crap out of them.
That's a very key thing is we don't, the whole stranger danger thing. I've mentioned this on a different podcast I've done, not this one, but I never taught my kids to fear other people. But what I always taught them to do was ask permission. You cannot go anywhere without permission. You cannot do this without permission. You must ask mom and dad. You can't cross the street. You can't go talk to neighbor Joe, who we had a great relationship with. It was so ingrained in his mind. Like he would be like, mom, like he would have to come get me. And so there were a couple of times, and it was rare that I told him no, but most of the time I just needed to know where he was. So it was the same outcome. But without instilling fear in him of his neighborhood, of his neighbors, I think you hit it on the head. There's an age appropriate level. I have a 15-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 9-year-old. I am not going to present the same information the same way to my 9-year-old that my 15-year-old is able to listen to. He was actually even watching a clean documentary with me the other day. He's 15. And it got to a point where because of my background in this, I wasn't creeped out at all, but I always tell my kids, listen, you're not me. And if something's bothering you, you have every right to say, mom, I don't want to watch this part. And in hindsight, it made sense. He hadn't been exposed to some stuff. And he said, mom, I don't want to watch this part. And I was like, great. So I finished it on my own. And then I said, hey, when that part ends, this is what happens. Do you want to finish? And he said, okay, I just want to skip that part. It was bothering me. And it should bother you.
Probably what's bothering him most is watching it with you.
Well, that's a fair point.
He could probably watch it on his own, but watching something sexual with your parent is not comfortable.
And it was tame. Yeah. I mean, it was a documentary explaining, you know, from a Christian worldview, explaining, you know, some of the messages that kids are getting. So it was definitely tame for most 15-year-olds. But you make a very good point. So that actually brings up another topic. When you're presenting this information to your children, how would you say a parent should expect their children to respond? Number one, this is mom or dad talking about, even if it's appropriate, sexual topics. We're talking about naked bodies. We're talking about, you know, even if we're talking to a 16-year-old, 17-year-old, 18-year-old, some parents shut down because they don't expect their child to respond a certain way. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Honestly, yes. Yeah, but I'm sorry, but I'm going to put that back on you and say, honestly, I think that's why we have to start young. And I know for a lot of your listeners, it might be too late, but we need to start young, teaching our children the appropriate body parts, male and female, you know, using the appropriate terminology so that, because if you're afraid to use that, they're going to think they shouldn't be using those words either, right? So, you know, and I just want to say, I love what you said about respecting your child's boundaries. That's huge. I think one of the things that we in Western culture have made have done not a good job of in the past is forcing our kids to say, you know, kiss Auntie Phyllis or whatever and hug so-and-so, right? Like when their gut instincts are saying, no, I don't want to do that. And you force them, they get this message that they're not allowed to listen to their own instincts and that they have to allow adults to touch them, even though they don't want it. So I'm a big advocate that, you know, we have to respect our children's boundaries so that they have bodily autonomy. And to, you know, give them the choice. Do you want to, you know, hug Auntie Phyllis? I'm saying it's okay. If you want to, you can. But if you don't want to, you don't have to. So I love that you said you respected his boundaries.
Yeah. And that's a great point too. Like my niece has children and they don't really know me yet. Like I come in and out and after, if I've been there multiple days, they're so sweet. They want to play with me. But I always tell them, like, if they're like, do you want to give her a hug? Goodbye? I'm like, you don't have to hug me. We can high five. Yeah, I can wave at you. Yeah. And sometimes they'll wave at me and I wave back, or sometimes they'll high five me and sometimes they hug me. But I agree with you. I think I would never want a child to dread me because I'm being forced on them. Even though I know I'm a safe person, they don't know me well enough to know I'm a safe person. Mm-hmm. And some kids are far less physical than other kids, and they aren't affectionate naturally. And that's a boundary you're forcing to break with them. And so I love that you mentioned that, because I think as parents, if we're a touchy-feely person, we don't understand why our child wouldn't follow suit. And you're afraid, let's be fair, as parents, we're like, well, I don't want grandma to be offended. I don't want Auntie Phyllis to like be mad at me. Get over it. This is your child. They have their own say in their body, and we need to make them feel like they can say what they don't want.
Well, the other thing is that they may have information that you don't have. For example, grandpa touched me in a weird way, right? I wasn't so comfortable with that. So, yeah, like.
Absolutely.
Right?
Like my grandpa used to give noogies, and I know that's like, it's not sexual, but I hated it. And because of he would grab me and like force me to like, and he, I don't know why he did it. Like it's weird in hindsight, but it made me not want to touch him. Like, and I think you're 100% right. There are things that kids pick up on or that may have been done, God forbid, to them that you aren't aware of. And if there is a boundary being broken, you need to, you know, you don't need to grill your child, but you should never shame them into physical touch. That's just not, that's like you said, that's setting them up for potential abuse or at least putting them in harm's way down the road, potentially, if we don't let them draw boundaries that are strict. So that actually is a good, well, finish what you were going to say. I apologize. I just had another question.
No, I was just going to say, may I use that as a segue into what we've kind of wanted to talk about? Because
that's,
you know,
perfect.
You said like even the noogies, right? So like you mentioned before, I mean, yes, stranger danger is still something we need to be aware of, but 94% of sexual abuse happens by someone that the parent and or the child or both know and love. So like when you mention those noogies, right? Offenders have a process that they typically go through, a grooming process that they go through before they offend against a child, right? So part of that process will include, well, first off, they groom themselves by putting themselves in, you know, educating themselves, getting themselves into a situation where they will have unfettered access to children. Unfortunately, that's the case. That's the reality. So they'll go get the degree that they need to so that they can be a teacher or a coach or whatever, right? That's the reality. They will put themselves in that situation. So that's stage one. They groom themselves. Stage two, they groom the parent. So they will befriend the parent. They will fill a need. They will win the parent's trust, establish a relationship. Step three, they win the trust and affection of the child. During that initial phase, before any sexual abuse ever takes place, they will establish non-sexual physical touch. So they will roughhouse with the kids, tickle them, give them noogies, wrestle, teach them how to subdue other children, play tackle football, often in front of the parent so that it is deemed that that physical touch between the two of them is acceptable. Now, I know that can be very confusing because, you know, lots of, like a majority of the people in your child's world hopefully will be non-offending people. But we have to be aware that the people that we want to kind of watch out for are often the ones that it seems either too good to be true or, you know, maybe you feel like you're doing them a favor or something like that, right? Maybe you got a red flag, maybe not, but if you do, please do not ignore warning signs that you might feel. So one thing that we want to be really cautious about as far as protecting our children is anytime an adult is trying to get alone time with your child. So let's say they've got tickets to a hockey game in a different city and they've only got one extra ones and they're willing to take your child. Ding, 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 red flag to me, right? Like, now you're going to be alone in a hotel room with my son? Not happening. I don't care how great of a relationship or how wonderful of a person, that is the process. And to me, that is just too high of a risk, whether they're family or not. You know, I mean, like, in my book, a lot of my participants, at least half of them were abused by a biological relative.
You know, and that's the challenge. That's the challenge people have with this truth. You will, if a child is sexually abused, you probably know them. And that is something parents, it is so difficult. I knew a girl growing up, a wonderful girl. She was younger than me in my youth group, just a delightful, delightful girl. And when I was in college, she was, I think, a junior or senior in high school, and she was raped by her brother-in-law in her own home. And she came forward, and thank God everyone believed her. And she became pregnant, and she gave her baby up for adoption. So it became a beautiful story out of a terrible story. But she was believed. And that is so, that was so joyful for everyone involved. I mean, just a tender, sweet heart of a woman. But even her sister believed her. And that must have been one of the hardest things that sister ever did. And yet, in hindsight, yeah, for sure. I'm like, what a brave woman. But to believe her sister because of the integrity of this girl. And yet, it is a hellacious thought to think that you would know someone who would harm your own children. My dad once told me, if anything ever happened to my kids, just give him a call. He's happy to go to jail on my behalf. He was sort of joking, but I actually just know my dad. Like, this righteous anger will well up in you. And yet, this is someone you've probably had a relationship with for a really long time. That aside, though, because that's a conversation unto itself. Like, why these sicko predators would prey on such innocence. If your child, for whatever reason, what would you say to parents to be looking for? Let's say a parent is listening and they're saying, well, I don't really have anybody who's hanging out with my kids and I'm not paying attention that I know of, or should I suspect people in my life? We don't want to suspect falsely people in our life. We understand that. That's a fear thing. And yet, what would you say parents have got to watch for as far as signs from their child that something is wrong?
Different things at different ages. Like oftentimes in the very young children, they'll be talking about a tummy ache all the time, or because they're upset and they don't understand like the emotional implications, or kids that can't sleep, or kids that are regressing, like we're potty trained and now they're wetting the bed. You know, the child that's falling asleep in class sometimes. Honestly, sometimes kids that are diagnosed with learning disabilities or ADHD or ODD, these are often manifestations of the trauma versus the actual versus what they've been diagnosed with. So sometimes it's the class clown because, you know, to be the class clown is easier than to say, admit I'm not following because I'm so distracted by my own trauma that I don't understand what's going on because because if a child's abused early in life, they may not learn how to self-regulate. They may not, you know, they won't be able to pay attention in class because they're so distracted by nightmares or daytime flashes of, you know, they're just dissociated, basically. So that can cause a child to fall behind academically. Unfortunately, there is no like one tell or anything like that. Like several of the participants in my book were A students that were like high level athletes because it's crazy, but the one in my research said, you know, I just knew that if I wanted to have a better life, he was being abused by his mother. And he said, I knew if I wanted to have a better life for myself, I had to do well in school because that was my only ticket out. Right. And he was meaning I have to make it through college. So he, in his own mind, knew he had to suffer this because I mean, one thing, I'll segue just for a second, then I'll get back to it. But like boys often fear that they're not going to be believed. So lots of times, you know, females feel that they will always have that support because it's pretty common knowledge that females get sexually abused. But it is still a bit of a taboo in society for boys to admit that they've been victimized or for people to recognize sexual abuse as sexual abuse. Because like we mentioned earlier, it's seen more as a rite of passage, as a coming of age. Even their own friends, if they were to disclose to them, might say, oh, you're lucky, you know, versus, oh, I'm sorry that happened to you, right? They get treated very differently by society, but also by the offender, which is a whole nother segue. But other warning signs that you might want to watch for is like, you know, like I say, kids that can't pay attention in school, kids that are falling asleep in class, bruises, that kind of stuff, kids without changes of clothes. But I mean, like, we're not necessarily talking that children have to come from a lower socioeconomic status to be abused. That's not the case. All children have needs. So unfortunately, offenders will look to fill any void. So if, for example, like, I mean, children that are more vulnerable, like those without a father at home or moms working three jobs, yes, they are more vulnerable, maybe more situated so that they rely more heavily on other resources where offenders will obviously make themselves be available as a resource. But the reality is any kid from any socioeconomic status can be abused, right? Yeah. In teenagers, I would actually watch for sudden and drastic changes in behavior. Now, oftentimes these are kind of chalked up as like, oh, they're turning into a teenager, but that doesn't necessarily happen overnight, you know? So when children all of a sudden, when young boys or girls all of a sudden go from being like, you know, attending Christian youth group, you know, wanting to hang out with parents, to not wanting anything to do with their parents, to experimenting with drugs and alcohol and that kind of stuff, those are huge warning signs to, or red flags to me. Often offenders will introduce them to substances. They will introduce them to pornography. With boys, they often offer to teach them how to masturbate, or they often teach them about masturbation. So I think it's very important that parents teach their boys, especially about masturbation, you know, that it's a solo sport. You know, you can say we prefer you don't do this, but offenders will often, you know, they kind of treat it like the forbidden fruit, you know, like, did God really say that you're going to die, or will you be like him? So offenders will kind of say, look, everybody does this. This is what men do. Your parents just don't want you to know how. But offenders will treat young boys as if they're older than they are. So that's another red flag to watch for, is if, and you may not necessarily see this, but offenders of teenage boys, for example, will try to introduce them to more masculine principles than are age appropriate. You know, maybe even introducing them to alcohol, drugs, driving, pornography, ask them what they know about sex, and then offer to teach them, that kind of thing. So oftentimes these boys have done things that they know their parents would not allow. So the offender will kind of throw that back on them and say, you know, you can't tell your mom and dad, because if you do, we'll both get in trouble. So, you know, or they'll make threats, like, you know, threaten to either start abusing the younger sibling, threaten to, you know, wreck dad's reputation, that kind of thing. So it's crazy the way offenders will use threats. But, you know, so the other warning sign out of that would be unexplained anger, right? Like, your teenager's walking around with a chip on their shoulder. Why? I mean, you know, many teens can make it through their teenage years and still experience all the hormonal changes without having this huge chip on their shoulder. So if your teenager is refusing to talk to you or pushing you away, because especially, you know, teenagers who've done something they know they could be in trouble for, or that they don't want to talk about, they will distance themselves from those that they're closest to because they don't want to accidentally disclose.
And that's right? So, they don't, because they don't want the shame of it or the threat or whatever,
shame.
They don't want that.
Yeah.
What you and I know are normally completely hollow threats. They don't know that.
Yeah.
They don't know the fact from
absolutely.
Fiction. And so they are afraid they're going to start this snowball. You know, it's like with any other human trafficking thing I've ever learned, there's always an innocent, meaning like the threat of an innocent. If they themselves will
absolutely.
Take it and say, you know, I'm oversimplifying, but if they are willing to take the hit, so to speak, and come forward,
yes.
But if that, then that groomer or that aggressor will say, well, what about your, and they'll go for an innocent, a little brother, little sister, cousin, even a child, if it's a young mom, and they'll just go down the list until they find what currency will work with that child, and they'll hold that against them to keep them quiet.
They're not always empty threats, right? Because, yeah, if you've got the coach who has access to other people, or, you know, yeah, I mean, I've heard of cases where the male will take the abuse so that his younger sibling won't have to, or that his classmate won't be starting to, yeah.
Or like you were saying about the coach, they'll pull them from the team a couple of times to let them know they mean business if they resist whatever it is that abuser is wanting to do.
Okay, everybody, thank you again for tuning in. That is part one with Dr. Kelly Palfy. Please check out her book, Men 2. I ordered it off of Amazon. I have it now. I'm going to start going through it. I actually got to know her through a different forum. So now that I know she has a book, I'm excited. Again, I understand this can feel heavy, but we've got to arm ourselves. And she is such a person of hope and such a person of honesty. And she wants to also talk to people who have been through trauma and who have said, gosh, this something like this happened to me or my brother or my aunt or my husband, and release the shame from it. God is not a God of shame. He's not a God of secrets, right? He is a mystery, but he's not a God of withholding good things, and a good thing is freedom. So I look forward to next time with you, and let's just take some time with the Lord and just have him filter what we've heard, and just find new compassion and passion for children, for men, and just to pray for the protection of our godly men. Till next time.